BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
It was a moment that shocked the world. In January this year, thousands of supporters of Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, stormed the country's parliament, presidential palace, and Supreme Court, protesting at what they saw was a fraudulent election that had ended Bolsonaro's time in office.
Jair Bolsonaro lost the election last October to the socialist candidate, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Our South America correspondent Katie Watson is in Sao Paulo tonight. Katie, what is going on?
There have been scenes of absolute chaos in Brasilia. The authorities have gained control over the government buildings.
The date was significant. Almost 2 years to the day, after supporters of former US President Donald Trump had stormed the Capitol in Washington, D.C. But the parallels don't stop there. In both cases, the crowds were egged on and encouraged by posts on social media and in WhatsApp groups.
These buses that were going to Brasilia, they were being widely coordinated through Facebook, through Twitter, and also through these closed messaging apps.
Many people saw the events in Brasilia as yet another example of how technology, and in particular the digital technology of the online world, poses a threat to democracy.
Are you accusing Cambridge Analytica of planting fake news?
Absolutely.
For some reason, people believe what other people say on social media. I think in the West, people haven't woken up yet to this new reality of deception.
Trump sent out the tweet with his explosive invitation.
I was pretty hardcore into the social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I followed, President Trump.
I'm David Baker, and I've lived and worked a lot in Brazil, often reporting on technology. And what I saw happening in Brasilia made me concerned, not only for the political future of the country, but also more widely, because events like that only bolster the argument that our online world is a threat to our democratic values. But I think there's another side to this story. In many places around the world, technology is emerging as a means of strengthening democracy and reconnecting people with their governments. So for this episode of the documentary, I'm going to be meeting people who are finding ways of using technology to enhance rather than destroy the democratic process. We'll be traveling to the vibrant West African city of Lagos to meet the civic tech entrepreneur who's using government data to hold Nigerian politicians to account. We'll head to Estonia on the icy shores of the Baltic to discover how the country has put practically all government functions online. In Taiwan, we'll hear how Parliament is taking citizen involvement to another level, turning social media algorithms on their head. And then we'll head south to the Pacific island nation of Tuvalu to meet the government minister who's recreating the entire country in cyberspace before it's submerged by rising sea levels. And all through this journey, I'm going to be finding out more about the new world of digital democracy and asking if technology, rather than being used as a tool to chip away at the very foundations of the democratic process, could actually save democracy itself. But first, let's get our terms right. What is democracy? Well, it's a way of governing that emerged 2,500 years ago in Europe, in ancient Greece to be exact. Here's how the modern-day Council of Europe, the continent's human rights organization, defines it.
The word democracy comes from the Greek word demos, meaning people, and kratos, meaning power. So democracy can be thought of as the power of the people, a way of governing which depends on the will of the people.
But of course, we now live in a very different world to the ancient Greeks, and a lot of our life, including politics, takes place online. So what then is digital democracy? And how can it ensure that people's voices are still heard?
I think there's two main ways in which digital democracy really can work. One is broader, which is politics and political activity and fundraising and recruiting and electoral work, and all of that can happen online. There's then a much more important version of digital democracy, which is about the kind of use of political power using digital platforms. So that's actually decision-making. I'm Carl Miller, and I'm the research director at the Centre for the Analysis of Social Media at Demos.
Demos is a research organisation based in London. And Carl has been studying the effects of technology and the internet on democracy for more than 10 years.
I think a criticism that I have had for decades now is this problem of how you make democracy much more everyday. This kind of conception of democracy essentially being us voting once every 4 or 5 years in general elections. And actually that creates a kind of form of engagement which is very, very distant from normal people. And I guess the kind of promise digital democratic reform has always had is that you can kind of use it to bring many more decisions much closer to people that they can get involved in if they want to have more of a say over the things that affect their lives.
The use of technology to engage people in political debate is increasing. And, says Carl, the good news is that it can be used to actually help people reach a consensus.
Probably one of the most important things that digital democracy can do is actually to move us beyond majoritarian outcomes. So it's not just about 51, 52% versus 48% on particular decisions. The most interesting digital democratic initiatives for me around the world have been the ones which are trying to create super majorities, ones which find ways of unearthing genuinely broadly held consensuses that almost everyone actually discovers they agree with.
One such digital democratic initiative can be found in Taiwan. In 2014, angered by what they saw as the Taiwanese government's disregard of their views about a potential new treaty with China, hundreds of Taiwanese students and civic activists stormed the country's parliament building to demand change. Remarkably, in response, the government began to explore ways in which its citizens' views could be better heard. And the result was an initiative called V-Taiwan, a means, both off and online, through which people could debate issues that they wanted Parliament to rule on.
So they began this kind of exercise around digital democracy, one which created entirely new ways for laws and regulations to be passed. And it was a way for people to become involved in a digital democratic decision-making process, unearth those super consensuses, and then to turn that via the Parliament into law.
One of the earliest issues that citizens were able to debate on V-Taiwan was whether or not to allow Uber, the US-based ride-sharing company, to continue to operate in the country. Uber had arrived in Taiwan in 2013, but from the start, it had faced strong opposition from existing taxi drivers. V-Taiwan used a platform called Polis to bring together people's views from all sides, similar to a social media platform, but with a key difference.
They begin to debate. They begin to offer views, respond to each other's views. But here's a key thing, and this is why the online debates on Polis look utterly different. In fact, the opposite from the kind of online debates that we would have on Facebook or Twitter. The views which Polis tried really hard to unearth were the ones which tended to get support across partisan barriers. Polis could see, using very clever maths, the view was getting support across the boundaries and distinctions or splits that existed. It's an engineering tweak. It's different to the way that social media normally works.
The way Polis worked was that it plotted people's views on a digital map, which updated in real time as the debate evolved and showed when different opinions were converging. And that, says Helen Liu, professor of political science at the National Taiwan University, was key to building consensus.
The technology actually allowed for people to see each other's ideas in a more visualized and more clear way. It was a technology almost like an AI. They were actually being able to classify or group those ideas into different categories and different themes. And then people start to see the emergent themes, right? What is the themes that, you know, people disagree on? What are the themes that people agree on? Sometimes you'd be surprised. Even you thought we're very polarized. You know, you stand on the yes, I stand on no. But there are something people actually share some common grounds. And so through this platform, you reveal those ideas.
And the end result, says Carl Miller, was little short of astonishing.
Over time, groups moved closer together. And at the end of the process, and we're only talking here a question of weeks, what would begin as an angry, polarised, split, divided debate, everyone remember what Uber regulation debates were like. I mean, you couldn't get anything more angry or more divided than that. Instead, you had groups forming in one great big supergroup around super consensus statements. So these were statements which 85, 90, 95% of the participants all agreed with. And it was those that they turned into laws.
But, Helen says, there was also another aspect of policy's technology that enabled people to come to a consensus. The way it makes participants pause and think before posting their opinion.
One of the things, before the citizen can contribute or do something, it actually requires some training. So it actually requires anybody who become registered or contributor on that platform. You need to read about the policy, you need to watch a video, or even they will launch some of the in-person meetings so you can actually watch about the meeting online, and then you go the next stage to express your opinion. That's very different than social media or other type of purely just express your ideas without reading other people's ideas or learning more about the policy.
Taiwan is now using V-Taiwan and similar initiatives to involve citizens in decision-making at every level of the country. And it has inspired people in other parts of the globe to develop technology that can bring citizens closer to those that govern them. Lagos. This is West Africa's largest city. It's a young city and the business hub of Nigeria, a country that has a pretty serious reputation for corruption and lack of government accountability. And it's here that Olusun Onigbinde has swapped a career in finance for one in the country's burgeoning civic tech sector, which is developing apps and websites designed to hold politicians to account. One of these is Budget, which Olusun founded in 2011 to make Nigerian state expenditure more transparent to its citizens.
Budget is a civic organization based in Nigeria and other West African countries focused on ensuring that public resources are optimized and efficiently work for the people. Our work is about taking public data from a very difficult level and making sure that everyday citizens can understand how public resources are spent.
In Nigeria, as in many countries, the government's obliged to publish details of how it spends taxpayers' money. But often those financial reports are complex and hard to understand.
This financial data could be arcane and difficult to break down by citizens, or citizens are unable to understand how to personalize the information to a level that they can hold government accountable. So what we do is to make sure that all the citizens understand what's in the budget for them. The fundamental question that we're asking, what is in it for the roadside market seller? What's in it for the primary school teacher? What's in it for the young student? Or what's in it for a contractor? That's what we are asking. And so we strip the budgets of the arcane details.
Budget reveals where government money is being spent. And it works alongside another app, Tracker, that Olusun also developed, that monitors the projects it's supposedly being spent on.
How do we start prioritising the needs and of the citizens? How do we ensure that capital projects that are meant to improve the quality of life of citizens get done? Because we can't make an assumption that it's going to happen.
Olusun says that civic engagement like this, holding the government to account, means creating a new mindset in many of Nigeria's citizens, and in its politicians too.
It's a way to challenge and change the narrative. Recently there was a report around poverty statistics in Nigeria, and the Nigerian Bureau of Statistics said 133 million Nigerians are multidimensionally poor, which just means that despite the significant resources the country has received over the years, we have not been able to translate that to quality of life. If we want to translate that, we have to ask a question on public sector efficiency and accountability. We also have to make sure that public office holders change their mindset and say this is not government money, this is public money.
Olushin is proud that he and his colleagues in the civic tech sector have been coming up with solutions to some of Nigeria's problems themselves, rather than, as is often the case in Africa, waiting for help from European or American organisations.
The people closest to the pain must stand in the front line on the issues. And for us, looking from a position of pain, you know, not being able to see the quality of governance expected, considering the significant resources that Nigeria has. And I think that has been the solution. That's what crafted the solution.
Startups like Budget and Tracker in Lagos are spreading through sub-Saharan Africa as a way for grassroots activists to change the way government works in their countries. Kilometres to the north, on the chilly shores of the Baltic Sea, is Estonia, a country of 1.3 million people. And there the process has worked the other way around. The government itself has spent the last 30 years making itself more accessible to its citizens. Estonia is right on Russia's doorstep, and it was occupied by the Soviet Union after the Second World War. So when it gained its independence in 1991, after decades of centralized Soviet rule, it needed to build its own government services from scratch. And it did that digitally.
The tax board was our first e-service. The electronic tax board was created just because, you know, Estonians didn't pay taxes in the Soviet Union. No salary, no tax. I'm Kersti Kaljulaid, former president of the Republic of Estonia. We had to start paying taxes and asking Estonians to go somewhere in some office with some papers and maybe queue, and thereafter have to pay taxes. I think none of us would have done it. I wouldn't have done it in 1997. It's the first year I declared taxes, and I did it online. This way, the tax collection massively improved because at least it was hassle-free.
That hassle-free approach to government was achieved by giving every Estonian citizen a unique digital ID, which can now be used to do pretty much anything in Estonia, from accessing government services to signing contracts to managing your health records. And it has meant that Estonian citizens have some of the smoothest interactions with government in the world.
It's huge efficiency gain. We believe we save actually 5 working days every year from not running from one place to another to administer our documents.
It does sound a lot better than the constant queuing, form filling and multiple logins the rest of us face when we're trying to do something like apply for a new driving license or register a birth. But isn't there a danger that centralising all this information online gives the state enormous power over its citizens?
Within Estonia, the state has set out quite a good set of laws which prove to the citizen that the government is restraining itself from looking at this data to use it against citizens.
And the way the system works is that the only person who can see all the information the state holds about them is the citizen themselves.
If my doctor, for example, is checking for, I don't know, results of an analysis, she has or he has absolutely no access to, let's say, to my driver's license or where I live even. Police officer who sees my punishment registry, how often I have been going too fast on the roads, cannot see how many children I have, for example. It's all compartmentalized. So basically, you are not allowed, even if you technically can. For example, you are a doctor and you want to check, let's say, the health status of your old girlfriend's new boyfriend. You're not allowed to do it. And if you do it, the state takes you to the court and you will be prosecuted.
And she says, having everything online means Estonian citizens can still do business and interact with government departments, even when they're outside the country. Kersti was able to use the system herself to appoint a new prime minister when she was on a presidential state visit to Portugal.
The Estonian citizens who live elsewhere and function seamlessly within Estonian society. For example, I signed the document giving Yuri Ratas the right to form a government from Portuguese Parliament building, because I just happened to be there when the time in history happened that I had to appoint the candidate for prime minister.
And she says putting the government of the country online has made Estonia more democratic.
I think this has strengthened hugely our democracy, I'm quite sure.
Being able to access government services from outside the country has enabled Estonia to maintain contact with the large number of its citizens who live and work overseas. It has done this happily, recognising that many of its citizens have voluntarily chosen to relocate elsewhere. But what if you have to become a digital citizen of a country? Not through choice, but because the country you live in may be about to disappear from under your feet. About 14,000 kilometres from Estonia, on the other side of the world, roughly halfway between Australia and Hawaii in the South Pacific, is the island nation of Tuvalu. The country is made up of 9 coral reef islands that sit only barely above sea level.
Tuvalu is one of the smallest countries in the world. Average height of the land is 2 metres. The highest point is about 4 meters, and so we're quite vulnerable to the climate crisis. My name is Simon Coffey. I'm the Minister for Justice, Communications and Foreign Affairs for the government of Tuvalu. The science is telling us anywhere between 50 to the next 100 years, the islands would be fully submerged by sea.
Faced with the possibility that it will physically disappear as a nation, Tuvalu is creating a digital version of itself online. So, if the worst does happen, it can continue to function as a state.
We're building a digital nation. My definition of a digital nation is a nation that has migrated all its administrative and governance systems online so that it's able to function as a state regardless of whether it has a physical territory or not. It's completely operating from cyberspace and it's able to fulfill all its international obligations, retain its sovereign rights and sovereign assets. And that's what we are pursuing.
When Tuvalu exists online, its citizens, as in Estonia, will find dealing with the state a smoother and quicker process. But, Simon says, the future digital version of the country will be about much more than just government services.
We're looking to also digitize our culture, our history, arts and stories. And we've chosen the metaverse to build a digital copy of Tuvalu because we feel that it's a very immersive experience that people can have in a way that they interact with the information that is presented in cyberspace.
And I think this will include everything, including, you know, recipes and wildlife as well.
That's correct. Wildlife, the environment, the ocean, even data that is being collected in real time, fishing activities that are taking place in our waters, all that would be on the virtual copy of the island that people can see.
It's hard to imagine how distressing it must be to have to prepare for the possibility that the country you live in will physically disappear. But Simon sees a positive side to Tuvalu's digital project. The chance to alert people in the rest of the world to the reality of climate change.
It's devastating for anyone to even consider or to think that they'd lose their homes in the future. And so that's something that's always at the back of our minds. We hope that it strikes a chord with leaders and people around the world that Tuvalu is taking steps to prepare themselves for the worst-case scenario.
And the country is determined that even if its citizens are based within another country's physical borders, they will still keep their connection with the Tuvalan nation.
For the government, culture is a very important part of Tuvaluan life. We are predominantly a community-based society in that we value the well-being of every member of our community, the well-being of our young people, of our elders. And that community culture, that sharing culture that we have in Tuvalu, it's something that we want to preserve. So if you're a Tuvaluan, wherever you are in the world, or if these values that we talk about resonate well with anyone, wherever you are in the world, then you can be part of this digital nation.
Speaking to Simon made me sad. Must be heartbreaking to know that the land you live on will at some point disappear from under your feet. But it also filled me with some hope, not only about the possibility that we all might wake up to the real effects of climate change, but also that using digital technology, we can preserve and even strengthen many of the things that connect us as citizens of a nation. No one on Tuvalu wants to lose their islands. But the country is showing the world that nations, governments, culture, and yes, democracy, can still exist, even in a digital form. Here's Carl Miller.
Democracy itself is a form of social technology, which over our history has been experimented on, has been changed. We've piloted certain techniques and we've tested them, and sometimes they've worked and sometimes they haven't. And I think that is a very, very precious thing. I think it's very dangerous to think that democracy can never change in the future.
Thank you for listening. There will be more from the documentary podcast soon. The documentary is just one of our BBC World Service podcasts. There are many others to choose from.
When you meet someone online, can you trust they are who they say they are?
I just started to interact with this person.
I keep thinking so much about you.
Love, Janessa, a true crime podcast from the BBC World Service and CBC Podcasts, investigating the murky world of online romance scams.
It's all well planned.
She said, if you really loved me, you'd do what I asked you to do.
Catch up with the whole series now. Search for Love, Janessa, wherever you found this podcast.